Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome today. Before we jump into our conversation, I want to remind you that support for WEAA is provided by... Who's it provided by? I have the wrong thing for him. No, I don't. Bosch, offering Bosch dishwashers at your local Bosch retailer. And we're going to jump into our conversation here. On our way there, I want to remind you about what happened on this day in history as we open the show with every day. There's a lot actually happening on this day in history. It's interesting. This was a day at different points where countries in Africa regained their independence or gained independence from their European colonialism. In 1960, Somalia became independent from Italy. And in 1960, one of the most important ones for many people was Ghana becomes a republic. And Kwame Nkrumah became its first president. And no longer was Queen Elizabeth head of state. This was also a time in 1962 when both Rwanda and Burundi got independence from Belgium. And the British Cameroon North, which used to be Cameroon, which was the Germans took over, voted to become part of Nigeria in 1961 in a plebiscite. Not all was finished, though, because this is also when the Rhodesian police murdered 11 black people in the streets of Salisbury, the capital of Rhodesia, then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, in the continuing struggle for freedom in that country. This was also the day that in 2008 that President George Bush took Nelson Mandela off of the terror watch list, which was good of him. This was also when the Battle of Gettysburg began in 1863. And in Suriname, this is Keti Koti Day, which marks the abolition of slavery by the Dutch in 1863. And this is also the birthday, and we'll be hearing during our breaks clips of his music, the birthday of the remarkable Thomas Dorsey, who was born in 1899 in Villa Rica, Georgia. Of course, Thomas Dorsey is the father of modern gospel, started out as a blues man, then with the death of his wife and child, wrote Your Precious Lord and went to the church, and then went back to blues and ended up back in the church. And we've talked about his music a lot on our discussions of history of music, and we'll be playing his songs today. So we're going to jump into our discussion. I invite you all to join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages or tweet us at Mark Steiner. One of the things we've been looking at over the last weeks, all these things that have come down from the voting rights decision by the Supreme Court, which really, I would say, just ended the Voting Rights Act in America, that many people think was a disaster. The things that especially the Chief Justice, who's always wanted to see the Voting Rights Act be declared unconstitutional, had his way. We'll talk about that. But that, in the context of the Zimmerman trial, when you see things like the testimony of Rachel Gentile and what that was about, and how the press has covered it, how people have covered that, looking at what was tweeted by the daughter of the, I was going to say prosecutor, the defense attorney who was questioning Rachel Gentile, eating ice cream, saying now that we can beat stupidity by having our ice cream in the summer. The Paula Deen incident, which most people don't realize was actually brought, the case was brought by a white woman, not somebody of color, but lots of tumble out around that. Here in Baltimore, Chris Brown, who was killed last year by an off-duty Baltimore County police officer. That police officer was found innocent of all charges. We just finished interviewing the director of Fruitvale, Ryan Coogler, who we'll be putting on tomorrow. And that was, of course, the tragic death that took place in Oakland on the BART system. And Oscar Grant, and the story of Oscar Grant's last day in his life. The Supreme Court also passed the Indian Child Welfare Act. Upheld that a Native American man does not have the right or access to his child when it's been adopted away. And thousands of children are adopted away every year from Indian reservations in this island. People look at that in the Native world as almost stealing their children. That's still going on after the end of the boarding schools. But this way it's done through adoption. So there's a lot here. Affirmative action was decided. So people are questioning. So the whole issue of race kind of is erupting here in 2013. And we're going to talk about what that means in the nature of the 21st century society we're in, and how white supremacy and how racism infects the consciousness and the social being of the entire nation in many ways, whether you're black or white or Mexican-American or Puerto Rican-American, whoever you are. So we have with us here Dr. Jeff Menzies joins us once again, senior researcher at the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University, author of Dumb and Down, Reflections of the Miseducation of the Negro. Jeff, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks, Mark. I appreciate the invitation.
I appreciate you doing it for us as well. Dr. Derek Musgrove is assistant professor in the Department of History at University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Derek, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. Jason Silverstein is with us. He's a PhD student in anthropology at Harvard University, where he works with the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for African and African-American Research. Jason, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
And good morning. And Marta Mossberg's back with us, columnist for the Baltimore Sun and Frederick News Post. Marta, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
410-319-8888 is here. So join us here with your thoughts and ideas. So I want to kind of just really explore what this kind of confluence means. I think it's when all these things happen at once, there seem to be these waves at times in societies, Derek Musgrove, when things erupt. And they're erupting around us now, but if people are still afraid to tread on the underlying issues here when all these things surrounding us have to do with the history of race in our country. What do you think's at work, Derek?
You know, looking at all the controversies in the news right now and in the Supreme Court cases, I see sort of the success of a conservative definition of race and racial inequality. Specifically, what I mean by that is that if you look at, say, the Paula Deen controversy, folks are up in arms basically concerning her use of the N-word. And so there's this the personal expression of racial animosity that folks are very unhappy about. And on the same side, you see the Supreme Court essentially gutting the Voting Rights Act, pushing back affirmative action just a little bit more. And, you know, what that appears to signal to me is that when it comes to personal expressions of racial animosity, Americans are still very much offended by them. When it comes to public policy that deals with structural racial inequality, Americans are kind of over it in their majority. I think Barack Obama put it best when he said that, you know, white racial guilt is sort of exhausted. And when it comes to public policies that deal with structural inequality, we really have to look somewhere else because that's just not going to happen anymore.
Jeff, weigh in, and we'll get more specifics.
I'm sorry?
I said weigh in, then we'll get to more specifics.
Well, yeah, I think that, as the previous guest said, it's, we get these moments in history. Actually, you said it. We get these moments in history where, you know, where the bell rings a little louder than what is constantly ringing anyway. So, you know, I see this issue of race relations and racially-based politics. All of this, to me, is always there. It's always kind of like that background noise. But then we get these little backups, these little build-up points where things begin to clog, and the media does its job and promotes, you know, certain stories, certain attitudes, certain ideologies, certain issues that are taking place, and it comes together and forms this dynamic sort of like sentient experience where this being just exists called racism, and it shows up again, and then everybody gets to talking about it. But I think that these are always moments in which we can do a self-evaluation, you know, as individuals, as families, as collective communities, racial groups, class groups, and see where can we go? What do we need to strengthen up? What are our goals, you know, as a whole, as a nation? And I think that's what attempts to take place on the political level. But unfortunately, politics is never separate from the personal, you know. So the politician, you know, that's passing votes or making decisions as far as bills are concerned, rights are concerned, they have their personal stuff. And if they haven't done their personal work, we're going to be dealing with their mess. But just on the national level.
Marta, go ahead.
Well, you know, I feel like a lot of the discussion around Paula Deen is it acts as if she said the N-word today, not 30 years ago. And when you look at what happened with the Supreme Court striking down the Voting Rights Act, you're dealing with statistics that the act was based on that were in 1972. So things have changed. I mean, I wonder if sometimes if progressives actually believe in progress. And I wrote an article about that for the American Spectator last week, because you can't look at the facts that in the majority of the nine states that needed preclearance, there are more, percentage-wise, more African-Americans registered to vote than whites. And if you look at an election that happened a few months ago when, percentage-wise, there's higher percentage of African-Americans voting than whites, things have changed. And that should be recognized. There are still incidences of racism, certainly. But when they happen, they are just condemned. The racists are on the wrong side of history. So to act as if we live in a world that of 30, 40 years ago doesn't make any sense to me. You have to look at at voting statistics. You have to look at how the country has actually changed when you're making public policy, not look back to 50 years ago.
Jason, your shot to weigh in, then we'll jump into all this.
Sure. To me, I think that the way that things have changed seems to be that this modern version of American racism is no longer exclusively these overt acts, but you know, it's more of a quiet bias that's happening that's more difficult to prove. So I think that the reason that the Paula Deen case connects is because we know that for everyone who overtly uses this language, we know that there's also another employer out there who covertly, say, doesn't have any positions available, or, you know, in the rental market where we have different people treated differently in their applications just by race. And these are quieter things that maybe sometimes these big cases bring to the fore and start opening up, maybe letting us glimpse at the way that these less visible forms of racism are working in society.
So let me throw this out. I mean, one thing I want to explore with that, let's explore for a moment. 2013 and 1967 and where we are. One of the things that we talked about in the show last week, I raised the issue of a poll that came out. And the poll said that one-third of white Americans thought that Zimmerman was guilty and he murdered Trayvon Martin and should serve time for his murder of Trayvon Martin. Close to another third, a bit more, of white Americans thought that Zimmerman acted in self-defense, should be freed because he was being attacked. And about another third thought that they didn't know enough because they had to weigh the evidence and see where the reality was. And one of our guests that day, Edward Wyckoff Williams, who comes on the show a great deal, who's a contributing editor for The Root, looked at that and said, that gives me hope that things are changing. And you look at those numbers, and whether you taking the partisanship out of Republican Democrat for a moment, people who believe in racial justice see that embodiment at the moment through the Democratic Party because they're one of the vehicles and with Barack Obama, and that's almost a similar percentage of whites voted for Barack Obama. But the question I have is, when you look at that and say what happened with the Voting Rights Act in the Supreme Court, and I know there are the numbers that Chief Justice Roberts threw out about about the numbers of people actually voting were greater. However, what they didn't say was that places like Shelby County, Alabama, and parts of Mississippi, and many other places we can mention, instituted laws to minimize the black vote because they could. And now they are going to take those laws that ensure that black folks will not be elected in Alabama and Mississippi and in Texas, and now they will become the law of Mississippi. And it will become the law in Shelby, Alabama, become the law in many other parts of rural Alabama. So let's talk about, in context of all that, what do we think has changed? I mean, and politically speaking and socially speaking. So Jeff?
Yeah, it's Jeff, man.
Go, Jeff. Go.
Okay, so I once heard that Malcolm X stated, a person can be stabbed with a 9-inch blade, and if you pull it out 3 inches, that can be called progress. You know, and then, but I add to it, but the person still has a knife in their back and they're probably bleeding to death. And so when we talk about progress, yes, there has been change. Yes, there has been advancement. In fact, change is one of those things that's inevitable. But how has change occurred? Is it just a superficial change? Is it a change, as other guests were saying, that there are more black people voting, a higher percentage voting now? You know, is that change taking place? But what's happening at the core? Is this change in the law going to take us back to the age, as you were just saying, where black votes would be further disenfranchised, black votes would be further disenfranchised? As far as Paula Deen and her language, I like it when it comes to the surface. I love it, actually. You'll never catch me protesting against the use of that word as far as white Americans may be concerned. Because when you look at the use of the word, I mean, in its current context, in its racist context, that's where it came from. And there are too many, as far as I'm concerned, African Americans that are confused about what that word actually means. So we have a lot of youth. We got a couple of generations in now that actually use the word as if it's a term of endearment.
Right. So, I mean, so is it okay for one set of people to use the word and another not to? I mean, I just feel like there's a double standard there.
You never heard me say that, and I don't say that. What I'm saying is that the word has a racist context, And too many, as far as I'm concerned, African-American youth believe that it can actually be used as a term of endearment. To me, that's an issue, because that is not what the word means. It's a very racist term, and we all know that. But and then to go to shift to the point of the Trayvon Martin case real quick, to give the numbers of whites that are actually saying that George Zimmerman is not guilty doesn't speak against the racism that exists in America, because, in fact, George Zimmerman is not a white man. And so it's not like white folks are saying, okay, white justice for this racist white guy that killed this black guy. That's not what's happening. It's a non-white and a non-white in this situation.
Well, people thought that, you know, originally everyone jumped all over it, I think, because they did think that he was white, and then, oh, he's Hispanic. So so how does this change the debate?
He's of mixed heritage.
Right.
One of his parents is white, and I think that's where he got his racist instinct from.
Well, it could be that, or it could be also that it was admitted in the beginning of the trial, not to get sidetracked with this, that he has never related to the world as a Latino. He's always related to the world as white.
Well, but I could take that statement back a second, though. If he got his racist instincts from his white parent, I mean, so what does that say about, are other races not, I mean, can you not be racist in other races?
Racism you're operating out of. Because, you know, of course, with everything, there are various definitions. But, I mean, if his father has demonstrated himself to have racist tendencies, then, I mean, and the son is there as his son, then where would it come from other than the socialization that he receives from his parents?
Well, can I jump in real quick? Because this is where I think that...
Is this Derek or Jason?
This is Derek.
Derek, go ahead.
This is where I think the conversation sort of gets off track. You know, much of our understanding of how race operates in American society is rooted in this notion that racial inequality is fused to ideas of racial animosity. So in other words, to hurt black people, you have to be racist, right? That's the idea that I think a lot of people have. And so when we look at public opinion polls and we realize that overt personal racism is rejected by the vast majority of Americans of any race, and we look at, say, the governor of Mississippi, or even George Zimmerman, and we realize that they don't, in most cases that anyone can find, ever express personal hatred towards black people. We then get thrown off when we have a situation where there's a dead Trayvon Martin, or Mississippi, the moment the Supreme Court brings down its case last week and states its voting ID law. And I think that's because we think that the two are connected. We shouldn't look at it that way. There are issues of just sort of racial animosity, and then there are issues of racial inequality. And one doesn't have to hate black people to put in place policies that really hurt black people or any other minorities. So, for instance, you could probably make the case that most law enforcement in America wouldn't see themselves as racist, wouldn't understand themselves as racist, but we have a drug war that basically makes it so that the vast majority of the people in our prisons are black and brown. And that can be demonstrated by, you know, folks up at Harvard where Mr. Silverstein is or something like that. So, you know, I just don't think it's helpful to look at the two in that way. We don't have to prove that George Zimmerman hates black people to realize that he might have done something horribly, horribly wrong when he followed Trayvon Martin that evening.
But I always wonder what is progress then? When will we have achieved racial equality, and who's going to decide that? I mean, because it seems like all these markers along the road don't matter. We're still inherently racist. That just seems to be the constant answer from progressives, and so it's confusing to me as to when we've actually when life has changed, and how we can mark progress, actual progress.
Well, it seems like there's actually a very simple answer to that. I mean, you know, I'm making the case quite specifically that there's been tremendous progress in racial attitudes. There has not been, when it comes to, say, issues of criminal justice, particular racial progress. There has not been when it comes to the use of tests and devices, which is what Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act defines as a disqualifying factor for whether or not a jurisdiction should be covered under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which requires preclearance. You know, in a lot of southern states, those tests and devices pop up every year or so, including Virginia, Mississippi, Arkansas just passed one last week. And all of those states should have been covered under Section 5 had the Supreme Court not gutted it. So, you know, I think that we can have different measures for success. When it comes to attitudes, we're doing great. When it comes to voting rights, we're doing better than we were, but that's not great. When it comes to criminal justice, we're doing terribly.
I mean, there's an interesting quote here. We were talking about before we went on the air. We were talking about Junot Diaz, the writer, and one of the things he said was, you can kill off all the white people, it won't make any difference. Racism's still going to exist because it's become so deeply embedded in the culture that whether you're looking at America or whether you look at Vietnam, where everybody wants to become white, or whether you – no matter, I can name a dozen places like this. So, I mean, that's the part that I think, Jason Silverstein, people have a hard time getting to the root of. That's one of the most difficult discussions to have. It's one of the most difficult things for people to discern and figure out.
Right. And I also think that, you know, one of the reasons why racism or the effects of it would persist is that, you know, racism is also something that ends up being done to people and has, I mean, in my research, has long-term health effects. So we know that there is certainly not been a whole lot of progress made with reducing healthcare disparities. We know that these are things where, you know, black patients are three times more likely to have a limb amputated from diabetes than white patients. We know that they're less likely to get pain medicine when they need it the most. But we also know that discrimination becomes embodied in such a way that, the first generation of African Americans born in the post-Jim Crow era has now finally caught up to the life expectancy of white Americans 40 years ago, and that's not necessarily an accident. So I think there's also something to be said for that. You know, it takes a long time for, if you were to remove discrimination, whatever that would mean, you would still have the echoes of previous disparities.
Let me go to the phones here. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Please join us with your thoughts on all of this. These are very difficult subjects for us to talk about. We try to deal with them honestly and straightforward and kind of in a very kind of non-threatening way, I hope, here, so we can kind of get to the bottom of things and where our society is. 410-319-8888. Cindy in Timonium, you're on the air. Hi, Cindy. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. I think everybody's wasting their time because there is so much racism toward African Americans and people of color. And my example is my friend's nursing aide came yesterday on time. We were late because of confusion. And when we got home, she had been huddling for an hour underneath our very tiny porch while my neighbors peeked out at her from behind the fence. She could see them. And we have had black people come to our house. This is Timonium. And have the police called because they're standing on the front porch smoking a cigarette. And this is not one person in my neighborhood, but the silent majority in Timonium believes itself to be protecting itself from African Americans at mostly all times. So forget whether or not black people can be racist, and we need to start doing something about this silent majority that looks so pretty and clean and is absolutely furiously attempting to, and they could have called the police on my friend's aide. That's what they could have done. I'll take my answer off the air.
Yes, Cindy, I just think that you're extrapolating your personal experience into a mass experience, which you can't do right now. So I think that that's one example, and there's lots of similar examples, but you can't just say that all of Timonium is that same way. It doesn't make sense.
Well,
She didn't say that all of Timonium.
Yes, she did.
Jeff, hold on. We have to take a legal ID break. We're going to come right back and let you pick up, okay?
No problem.
Don't go away. In the Valley, Charles Dorsey. He was born in 1899, the man who created modern gospel. I will be playing his music during our breaks all morning long. We are here with Marta Mosberg, columnist for the Baltimore Sun and Frederick News Post. Jason Silverstein, PhD student in anthropology at Harvard University, where he works for the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for African and African American Research. Dr. Derek Musgrove, assistant professor in the Department of History at UMBC. Dr. Jeff Menzies, senior researcher at the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University, and author of the book Dumb and Down: Reflections of the Miseducation of the Negro. And before we go back to the phones at 410-319-8888, Jeff, you were about to say something. Respond to the issue around timonium and what our caller was saying.
Yes, Mark. What I just wanted to say is that, I didn't hear her saying that all the timonium was that way. I apologize if she said it and I didn't hear it. But what I will say is that the getting of personal experiences and transferring that to a semi-global experience is a valid way of assessing what's going on. I mean, the only way that we get census tract data is to go door to door and get individual input to discern what the bigger picture is.
But you're looking at a mass data point. She's talking about one.
I'm sorry. Excuse me 1 second. And so with that situation, we compile the data and we look at what's actually going on. But if we just take this bird's eye view, like we're up in a helicopter flying over Baltimore, for example, you know, you may not recognize the murder taking place on that corner. You may not recognize the police brutality taking place in that neighborhood because you're taking it far away from the street type of view. It's like a person flying a drone and dropping a bomb. They don't get the gore of that hand-to-hand combat, and they may think it's not as bad as it is on the ground. And so I just wanted to say that about her point. But also, when the caller spoke about the racism that exists in her community, and she said, we're wasting our time, is what she said. I disagree with that point, but I do agree that it's a very deep and unattractive, non-sexy work that has to take place. People really have to look at themselves. People have to look at their grandmothers, their grandfathers, myself included. We got to pay attention to our family lineage, our conscious and unconscious motivations for doing the things that we do. If we don't get there, then yes, we're wasting our time. But we have to do some deep work because racism is ingrained in the culture. Is it an individual thing? Yes. Is it a group thing? Yes. Is it an institutional thing? Yes. It's on all of those levels. And if we don't start working on it at a very deep individual level, we'll never progress.
So where is the intersection for all of you, before we go back to the phones at 410-319-8888, Clarence, you're the next caller up. Where's the intersection with the personal and the political? I understand what Cindy was saying. I mean, and let me just throw that out there. When I'm in circles, they're all white circles, invariably somebody's going to say something that is indicative of race or racism and not even seeing themselves as racist. I'll give you an example. One evening there was a group of people around and we were joking. People were talking about the light rail, Maryland's light rail system. And I said, we call it the snail rail because it's so bloody slow, who wants to take it? Someone else popped up and said, we call it the dark rail. The dark rail. Now, they weren't talking about night travel.
Right. What's the same?
What'd you say, Mark?
Well, that's a long story. But I immediately knew that and said this was a racist comment. And it was, you know, these kind of things that come flowing out all the time, or people who will that because it's embedded, and it gets embedded so deep in the consciousness of America, people don't even know what's happening. I said before we went to break, I said this to Marta Mosberg. This is where I want to know where the intersection of the political and the personal comes in, and how we root it out. I said that I think that on some levels, even though there's a lot of white liberal racism in the Democratic Party, I'll be the first person to scream it from the mountaintop. Even though I'm not in the Democratic Party, my else's party, I would scream it from the mountaintop. On the other hand, I said to Marta was that I think the Republican Party has been hijacked by racists. And I don't mean – and by that I mean the Dixiecrats who have become Republicans and their progeny, the folks in Wisconsin who ended up voting for George Wallace in 1972 are now Republicans. And this is part of the whole battle around voting rights, because everywhere those folks are in the majority, they put in practices that limit the rights of Native Americans, black folks, and Mexicans especially, to vote in our country.
Are you speaking specifically of voter ID laws or just a host of things?
A host of things. They just gerrymandered districts. From Shelby, Alabama will not have a black councilman anymore, as will cities and towns across Mississippi. Cutting back on the black representation in Mississippi is going to be the next. You'll see that happening next in Mississippi.
Well, couldn't you argue that that goes on in every state across the nation? I mean, look at what was going on with Maryland, how it was redistricted.
Specifically when it comes to denying communities of color not the right to vote, but the right to representation. So how does that mesh? How do you mesh this personal and political? Can it be meshed? Is it too difficult for us to kind of to parse out in our society?
I think it is meshed, Mark. I think that it will always be meshed. I think it's just how it's meshed is where we have our problem, or what the person of it being meshed in political creates problems. Then we have to question, well, who are these persons, you know, in the political realm? I mean, my simple point of it can't be unmeshed, and it will forever be meshed, because, again, politics is carried on by people.
And Derek, do you want to jump in, Jason, and also Marta?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a direct correlation between the larger events and forces that sweep across the society and people's personal decisions. You know, I think that images of crime on TV, the fact that so many black and brown people are in our jails, influenced George Zimmerman when he saw a black kid walking down the street with a hoodie on. And then he made personal decisions based on those ideas that he attached to that skin color and to that age group that had tragic consequences and that we're all following very closely up into the present. So certainly there's a very close connection. I think that when you start to talk about how to correct that, you know, there's a bunch of ways to address this. But, you know, my interest would be focusing on the policy, the structure, as opposed to the personal decisions. And so, you know, let's look at the issue of, say, the Voting Rights Act. A lot of the voter ID laws, the anti-fraud legislation that's coming out of Republican state legislatures in the last couple of years, roughly since 2009, is a product of large numbers of grassroots Republicans' belief that fraud is rampant within the Democratic Party, and specifically within black and brown elements of the Democratic Party. And that has everything to do with a push made, you know, really going all the way back to 1964 in the Goldwater campaign, but really ramping up during the Reagan years, that identified black and brown voters as fraudulent and put in place ballot integrity or ballot security schemes that would suppress the black and brown vote, and specifically the black vote when it came to these schemes in the 80s. And the idea behind those schemes was that, look, you have fraud here, and so we've got to police it. A lot of modern-day Republican activists have focused on that idea that there is fraud out there and have put in place these laws. And so you see the laws sort of springing from these individual beliefs that black and brown voters are just more likely to commit fraud than, say, other types of voters, because they're focused very specifically on those communities. And I think the focus should be on getting rid of those laws. You can't just get inside people's heads and hope that they'll think one way or the other.
What about Wendy Rosen in Maryland? I mean, she was running for the first congressional district, Democratic nomination, and she admitted that she voted in two places. I mean, these things do happen. I mean, and there are plenty of instances. There's thousands of people on Maryland rolls that shouldn't have been on the voting rolls either because they were students at the Naval Academy and then moved and didn't change or had died. There's plenty of people. You know, there's plenty of people in New York City who also have residency in Florida who had voted twice. This is not it's not just targeted, as you say, against black and brown people. This is wealthy white people doing this.
We do have to be very specific here. There's several consent decrees from the 1980s focusing on these specific programs where the judge in those consent decrees ruled that, in fact, the Republican Party was trying to suppress black and brown votes. And so there's not really a question about that. As for using the anecdote of that one candidate who voted twice, and there's no question that she did, and she should be prosecuted for it if she hasn't already. It seems odd that you'd use that just after you dismissed the caller for using an anecdote.
No. I also mentioned that there were thousands of voters in New York City, snowbirds, who went to who live in Florida half the time, who are also registered to vote there. So that's not anecdotal. That's thousands of people.
But that's not evidence of fraud. That's
we're talking about millions.
New York City needs the cleanest roads, but that's very different than saying that there is fraud here. That's saying that people never took their names off the rolls, which nobody does, quite frankly. I mean, very few people actually take the time when they move to send in the information to say to a state or a jurisdiction, please take my name off the rolls.
No, these were people who were voting in two places.
But we don't know that we're voting. I read those same studies, just to interject, I'm just looking them up right now again. I mean, there are no studies from either state saying there have been massive numbers of people voting in both states.
I think it was like a big New York Daily News investigation of this. So, I don't remember the specifics of it, and I don't have it in front of me, but I remember them saying that people did vote, people did vote twice.
But there's been very few cases or prosecutions of in-person voter fraud, which seems to be exactly what the voter ID laws address. I mean, even in the Pennsylvania case, ahead of their voter ID trial, the state stipulated that there had been no even investigation of an in-person voter fraud. And I believe that there were as few as 10 actual in-person voter fraud cases since 2000 that were uncovered. So I think there are a couple of different types of voter fraud here, and it's hard to see exactly how the voter ID measure, which was so popular during the or unpopular, depending on how you see it, during the last election cycle, was going to combat that. And it seemed that states even stipulated that it wouldn't.
Let me do this. I want to get back to the phone. So a lot of people have been wanting to call in and join this conversation at 410-319-8888. So please keep calling. And Clarence, you're on the air. Hi, Clarence. Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Steiner. Mr. Steiner, just let me throw something in here real quickly. You know, I could look myself in the mirror and I could ask myself a question. Why should you not be racist when the Supreme Court basically says you guys can put the best basketball team on the court, but the people that control the referees can, that's simplifying. The people that control the referees can affect the outcome, e.g. voting. When I, as an individual, look at America and see the white power structure being able to politically and economically affect almost every aspect of black people's lives, you can ask yourself why, when in the face of economic deprivation and lack of education, you're being socially segregated, when white institutions can gentrify cities almost at will. I'm not a practicing racist. I don't walk around the streets every day with a racist attitude. But in defense of my people, I can be sound very racist, you know. So, you know, that's the question that your guests need to look at. That's a question I think your guests need to look at, too. Thank you, Mr. Steiner, for your time.
That's interesting. Jason, you want to grab that one first?
Sorry, I didn't catch the very last part. I didn't catch the last part of that.
All right, he was talking about, I think, the power of the subtlety.
Oh, right, yeah. I mean, of course, I think that the tough thing here is that often the way that racism tends to work in modern American society is in such a way that, you know, we don't really perceive it until it has persisted for a while. And I think like a really great example here that ties into the Trayvon Martin case is how we perceive youth of color in this country and the juvenile justice system. We know, you know, as data gets collected, that basically state by state, youth of color are treated more harshly. They get more out-of-school suspensions. They get arrested and referred to law enforcement more quickly, tried in adult courts, sentenced more severely. And these are things that on the ground, probably people will say, oh, well, we're just enforcing our zero tolerance policy. However, it only gets applied in certain ways. So this strikes me as sort of this way that you have this more subtle type of racism that's happening that eventually when we pull back and we see it in the aggregate and we see it how it affects a huge population, we start to notice that, wow, we really do have have a problem here that I think, as the caller was saying, is starting to, or is definitely diminishing people's life chances, their chances of having a good life in this country.
Well, one of the things, talk a bit for a minute, just to throw this out, because I think it can be on what you were just saying. The studies you've done around about how people see each other and empathize or don't empathize with one another, and what that says to you in this context.
So this is called the racial empathy gap, and at its most basic, it's that there's a gap between the pain that we feel for ourselves and the pain that we perceive in other races. And as it turns out, people assume that black people feel less pain than white people. So you can go ahead and imagine all the different ways that this causes social problems. Two areas that we've discussed have been healthcare and the criminal justice system. In healthcare, we know patients get lower quality healthcare, and they also don't get pain management when they need it the most. And in criminal justice, as we've been talking about this hour, clearly there is race and empathy impact on jury decisions, not only in the juvenile justice system, but also in death penalty cases. And it tends to be this idea that people don't perceive black people to feel pain as strongly as white people. And that's not just white people. It's also black participants. And also, in a very scary way, it's been healthcare professionals. So to swing back to one of the early comments, it's people who probably really do care very much for the people that they're treating. They just happen to not recognize pain as much as they do in white people. And it turns out that the reason why is because of assumptions that because black people have faced more hardship in life, that therefore they can kind of withstand more pain, and therefore they're subjected to more pain.
If I could jump in for a second on that very study, it's a very intriguing study. And a lot of it has to do with also the empathy, you know, a person's ability to be empathic for another individual's pain. So on one level, yes, rate the amount of pain you think this person is in. But on another level, how did they react to the witnessing or the experience vicariously of another person's pain? And mm-hmm. that reaction was less for people observing an African-American or a black person. Now, this, and it has historical legacy. If you know, like J. Marion Sims, for example, the father of modern gynecologists, right? He is known to have performed a lot of his experimental surgeries on enslaved African women without the use of anesthesia. And so the modern techniques of gynecology, the instrumentation and everything that he used, he became very wealthy, by the way, was developed through totally inhumane experimentation, surgical experimentation on enslaved African women without anesthesia. And so it was a thing of always needing to animalize the group of people to create this perception that still carries on today that these folks are subhuman, these folks are not worthy of this level of support, this level of acknowledgement, and we need to get back to the good old days when they knew their place. And so we're just experiencing that. It's a modern version of what's been taking place, you know, in a racist world for quite some time now.
Go ahead, Marta.
I mean, that example is, it's awful what happened, but that's not right. What exists today. So,
but you put the button, it is what exists today. We could go back to the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks, you know, right. which was not on a plantation. That happened post emancipation. Or we could talk about, the fact that the police officers in Florida didn't arrest George Zimmerman after he had clearly murdered a teenage, unarmed teenage boy. So, when is present day? Like right now, let's look at all the murders that just took place in Baltimore.
You know,
and I'm sure if we evaluate it deep enough, we would see that it's set up by a condition within which these people are living in. These young black males, young black females are living in certain conditions that are known to create and generate a certain level of violence.
Well, this is...
just real quick, look up, just read the work of Watson. He's a behavior psychologist. He'll tell you all about it.
Well, I mean, if you're looking, I mean, but you're in speaking about murders in Baltimore or murders in Chicago, other places with black on black violence, that, I mean, you're basically, if you lump all that in, you're basically saying that people don't have their own agency. They are not capable of making their own choices.
I'm glad you said that.
And that argument is really troubling to me. I mean,
and it should be. It should be.
Let me let Marta finish her thought. You can come right back in, Jeff.
Well, no, I mean, and if you want to take it out, you know, people were talking earlier about the drug war. I mean, that to me is you know, if you're going to talk about institutionalizing racism, that question is about. I mean, I think the drug war is wrong, not because it disproportionately affects black and brown people, because it's absolutely wrong. And so there's choices that we make in our lives, and I feel like those are we're ultimately responsible for who we are. And you can't discount that from this discussion. I mean, you're treating everyone as if they're just born a victim, and that's just wrong.
Right, I hear you. And I do. Okay, let me excuse that part. I don't think that everybody's a victim. I'm clear about that. But you made a very good point about the possibility of people not having agency, people not being able to make clear-minded decisions for themselves. Now, see, what happens is everything in marketing is to change behavior. That's what marketing is about. Is to influence people's decision making.
Right.
So what I do understand, my background is a clinical psychologist, just to put it in context. I like to put my statements in context. Now, when you look at the ability to modify people's behavior, make people do what you want them to do, it's not a difficult thing to do. And what we have are certain situations that are set up. Like, for example, if we turn on a popular radio station right now, you know, playing popular music, popular culture video shows, you're going to see a very specific thing being repeated over and over again. And you will recognize that the majority of the things have to do with detrimental behaviors. And, you know, it's played repeatedly. And anybody who knows anything about human behavior knows that will shift and modify behavior.
Right. The more it's like the more you repeat something, the more people believe it, whether it's good or bad. That's just the way. Daniel Kahneman wrote a great book called Thinking Fast and Slow a couple years ago that talks about basically how irrational everyone is.
So what's your point in saying that?
What's my point in saying it? Well, I'm saying that we're all born with this tendency towards irrational behavior, but we're ultimately still responsible for our lives. So.
Because there's this notion of, you know, Marta brings up this issue of personal responsibility as it applies to my example of the drug war earlier on. And studies have shown unequivocally that drug use among whites and blacks is the same. The exact same numbers apply. Same number of people use cocaine, marijuana, whatever else you can think it is, but the policing of those communities, the willingness of the police to conduct a buy and bust on, say, you know, York Road is far higher than it would be in, say, Roland Park, Upper Charles Street, right? They don't do them up there. They do them down on York Road. And so who lives on York Road? African Americans. Who gets disproportionately swept up in the drugs? War.
Right, but to make that argument would be to say that murder is not right. Murder should be not a crime because more black people are put away for murder. I mean, the drug war, I think, is just inherently wrong for other reasons.
No, but I'm saying nothing of the sort. I agree with you that the way in which the drug war is conducted, and in fact, the drug war in and of itself has serious problems and should be totally revised, if not scrapped. But the fact of the matter is that it is woefully racially disproportionate. And so, you know, whatever we're going to say about the drug war as you know, sort of a policy, the one thing that we know from study after study after study after study is that at every stage in the process, it disproportionately targets African Americans, black and brown people more generally, right? And so that's very different than saying, well, black folks need to take responsibility for their personal activities. You know, so do white Americans.
Well, right.
One benefit they have in that process is the police aren't looking for them, looking to catch them taking drugs in the same way that they are their black and brown fellow citizens.
I mean, if you look at the ACLU study that just came out, and if you pick one county, or two counties in Maryland that are almost all white, Cecil County and Garrett County, over 85% of the arrests for marijuana in those counties were black people. That's targeting. That's not a mistake. I mean, 6% of the people of Cecil County are black, and almost all the arrests of people using drugs in Cecil County are black.
I haven't seen the study, so I don't want to talk about it.
I mean, so
okay, but see, Mark, this stuff is known, man. And I think what happens is that in conversations like this, we tie up the discussion and we prove the point, prove the point, prove the point. And the point has been proven. I mean, you can take it back as far as you want to or bring it up to this very second, and you will be able to find a plethora of examples that substantiate the point that racism does exist. But again, if it's only about arguing, everybody has something that they can argue.
So the question happens, I'm sorry, finish up, Jeff.
So what happens is when we study arguing and arguing and arguing, nothing actually gets done. Is in that progress that was asked about earlier, it tends to be like a dog chasing its tail. It just runs in a circle.
Well, I mean, I think that maybe what we pick up next time is what progress means and how we move ahead in this 21st century. I think there's a lot there that we can think about. We're just about out of time here in this segment, and I really appreciate all the people taking part in this segment today. But to look about where it goes and where how we have changed in the last 100 years in this country and how much further we have to go and what the personal political struggles mean in America now. And how we get there. I think that that's what we've been talking about a lot in the show in the last few weeks with different people, and we're going to continue that conversation. I think it's critical, and we will be coming back to it after the holiday. We're actually going to move in now into a discussion on how poverty affects the brain, and new studies have come out, which are pretty stunning studies about what stress does to the function of the brain and to the development of the brain and more, the stress of poverty, I'm saying. And we just heard Dr. Jeff Menzies. He's senior researcher here at the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University, author of the book Dumb and Down, Reflections of the Miseducation of the Negro. Dr. Derek Musgrove, assistant professor in the Department of History at UMBC, who was last on the show when we did our program on movement and the music at UMBC. Jason Silverstein, who's almost Dr. Jason Silverstein, PhD student in anthropology at Harvard University, where he works with the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for African and African-American Research, and we'll be linking to the research he's been doing on empathy on our website at steinershow.org, and Marta Mossberg, columnist for the Baltimore Sun and the Frederick News Post, and also on our steinershow.org, you will see links to the study we were talking about, the ACLU and the marijuana arrests that we've been talking about here ever since it came out the other week. So we are going to go out now with more of Dorsey's music, celebrating his birthday, born in 1899. The Lord will make a way somehow. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Don't go away, folks. Next segment coming.
Like a ship that's tossed